Welcome to Jewish Singles Radio. I am your host, Valerie Zaslow, along with Diana Pivenstein.
Hi, everybody.
Jewish Singles Radio was created to bring Jewish men and women together to build an engaging, like-minded community where we can connect and have authentic, meaningful conversations about dating after 40. If you are divorced, widowed, a single parent, or maybe you have never even been married, we hope that you will not only meet new people through the age-old art of conversation, but that you will also learn a lot.
So join us every week. We're going to be talking to dating coaches, health and wellness experts, matchmakers, religious leaders, educators, and other singles. We know that managing modern dating and navigating the single life is not easy, so we want to help you through that process. Our goal is to provide you with lots of valuable information and have a lot of fun along the way.
So if you're Jewish and single, or single and looking to meet someone Jewish, let's talk about it. Every Wednesday night from 7 to 8, right here on WWDB AM 860 or WPEN 97.5 HD2. And you can hear us wherever you get your local podcast. So today we are speaking with best-selling author, speaker, and coach, Craig Stanland. He actually refers to himself as a reinvention architect. And he specializes in helping his clients to break free from what he calls the status quo and build the lives that they desire. After really hitting rock bottom and losing sight of what was important to him, he had to go through a very painful process of figuring out how to reinvent himself and really reorganize his life. I guess his philosophy is, you know, when you have nothing, anything is possible. So hi, Craig, welcome, and thank you for joining us today on Jewish Singles Radio.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm really excited for our conversation.
Hi, Craig. Nice to meet you.
Nice to meet you.
So we are speaking really about, I guess, starting over, kind of recreating yourself and reinvention. I know that you have a book that you wrote called Blank Canvas, and it talks about your experience, which is that you were actually incarcerated and spent 2 years in prison and kind of had what most people would think is like a perfect life, and made a hasty decision and found yourself in circumstances that perhaps no one expects to be in. But really through that, you changed the course of your life. And perhaps sometimes we have to go through certain experiences to come out on the other side and find out, you know what, this is where I was meant to be. Not that this is the road that I plan to travel in terms of how I got there. So maybe you could tell us a little bit about your story and exactly where you are and what you're doing today.
So thank you so much for this. You alluded to some of it. I really did have, prior to being arrested by the FBI, I had what many would consider was it all. I owned multiple homes. I was married to a beautiful, incredible woman. I wore all the nice watches, ate at all the fancy restaurants. And like you said, I really lost sight of what was important. And I made the choice to commit fraud against one of the largest technology companies in the world. When I was arrested by the FBI, my entire life changed. I lost everything. I lost my career. I lost my wife. I lost my homes, the cars. I lost the ability to work in the industry that I was in. There's a court order barring me from my old industry. So I really had to make the choice to step out of the burnt ashes of what was my former life and to create something new. And it was a long and arduous journey, but now I can say that I'm living a life that I absolutely love, of writing and coaching and speaking and being of service to others. And I love what you had said earlier, that it was much different than the expectation. I think that's something so interesting for all of us to consider, is we have these expectations of what we think life is going to be like. And when all of a sudden a curveball comes along, and we don't have those expectations, that's where so much suffering can occur. And I think that's just so interesting for us to look at that and to, when life throws us that curveball, what are we going to do? How do we move forward?
So, Craig, I know that you're starting your story with how it ended, kind of, how you got arrested and you ended up in that situation. But I wanted maybe to talk to you about, you said that when you were married and you were living like this false life, like I listened to your TED Talk, how you were saying that every day you were, you know, scared that you're going to get exposed and that you were living like this different life and that your wife didn't know and all of these things. Do you think that that was the beginning of how you were getting to rock bottom? Like not being honest in your relationship from the beginning kind of brought you to that point?
I literally just got chills from your question. This morning I write every single morning. And this morning I was exploring the idea that I've always said that the day that the FBI arrested me was the day that my life changed. And this morning I said, you know what, that's not quite right. It actually began the moment I chose to commit the fraud. And that was really you are so insightful that you nailed it.
Well, in
that regard.
I did listen to your talk, and I was, when you were talking about that, it seemed as equally, it seemed like you were as equally affected by living like that as you were with what happened after.
As a matter of fact, I thought that in listening to you speak, that you really felt like you knew what you were doing while you were doing it, and you really ignored your own instincts, you know, and were kind of aware. And I think that a lot of times maybe we do go through a process like that where you're doing something that you're not comfortable with within yourself. And maybe you kind of question yourself, but you don't want to realize what's on the other side, what this might lead to or what might happen, because you don't want to put yourself in a position where you're in pain or struggling or in feeling a sense of loss. Do you feel like that's what you went through?
That's absolutely what I went through. I knew what I was doing was wrong. And my fraud was a series of hitting the enter button on my keyboard. And every single time that I, you know, sent an email, that I perpetuated the fraud, my heart said, stop, don't do this. This is not the way. And I ignored it out of fear, because to me, the alternative to committing the fraud was to be honest with my wife that my paychecks were shrinking, that my performance at work wasn't what it used to be, and that I couldn't afford the lifestyle that I had been providing for us. And I was so afraid to be seen as less than that, violating my heart and going against my values, it, as crazy as it sounds, that seemed like the better option.
Right. I mean, maybe getting back to what Diana asked you, I mean, I'm just curious. So really you were in a place right from the very beginning where, you know, you realized that there was, or did you even realize that it was a problematic relationship? And, you know, it seems like you almost had everything that you could want, yet, you know, you were reaching for a way to have more.
I was reaching for a way to have more because I was not appreciative of everything that I had, in conjunction with not feeling worthy of everything that I had. My identity and who I had become was so interwoven with my things and my ability to buy those things. And so when my paycheck started shrinking, it was threatening my very identity, and that was utterly frightening to me. And it you know, at the time, I didn't think that my relationship was problematic. Looking back now, with the hindsight of 2020, I can absolutely see that and agree 100%.
So kind of, it's in a way, in a different kind of way, it's kind of almost like cheating. You know, you're kind of, but in a different way, it's not that you had a different person. You were cheating with this other lifestyle that you were presenting to who you were with.
What an interesting analogy. And I like that. Nobody's ever presented that to me. And I'm going to have to give that a little bit more thought. And you had mentioned something in one of your previous questions that was really the key word, was honesty. And that's where I can see where you're pulling the cheating from. is I was just not being honest. And honesty is the core foundation of any relationship, not just marriage, but any relationship.
So do you think that, like, when was the beginning of that? Like, you guys met and everything was great. And then when did it start to, you know, deflect from that? Because I think a lot of people that are listening, and even the people we have in our studio, may have had some kind of experience with that in some way or another, where they were in a normal relationship and then it started to kind of move away from that and take on a different identity.
I would say that it started very early in our dating. It started when I was already very successful, but I would overinflate and exaggerate how much I made. I'm trying to think how to say this. It's not that I came up with brand new numbers, but I made the existing numbers sound better than they were. And I started creating this image that I then had to live up to, because I, even when we were dating, I put, you know, she was my girlfriend at the time, I put her on a pedestal and I made up a story that I have to be this certain person to be able to be with her. And that started very early on in the relationship.
I think that a lot of it has to do with your values and what's important to you. And perhaps we feel like we have that all figured out by the time we're adults. You know, we kind of go through a life of education and meeting people and having relationships along the way, whether they're professional or whether they're romantic. And you develop what you feel like makes you as a person, what you feel like is going to be you know, the course of your life, which in fact you did, and you said yourself you were really happy with everything, but for some reason, you know, something kind of breaks in the chain, and sometimes it's hard to figure out, like Diana said, like, where exactly did it start to fall apart? So right now we are going to take a break, and when we come back, we will talk more about that. So stay with us. You're listening to Jewish Singles Radio on WWDB.
On the battlefield, there's a saying America's military men and women live by: never leave a fallen warrior behind, ever. Off the battlefield, Wounded Warrior Project operates with the same goal: we leave no warrior behind. Wounded Warrior Project is a nonprofit organization created to help our men and women returning home with the scars of war. Whether those scars are physical or mental, we're here to make sure that they heal. And whether it's helping those with post-traumatic stress disorder live a normal life again, or giving much-needed support to injured warriors and veterans hospitals, because no one deserves our help more than the men and women who risk their lives to keep us safe. Wounded Warrior Project. We never leave a fallen warrior behind, ever. Learn more about what we do at woundedwarriorproject.org.
Serving my country required sacrifice, sacrifice that changed my life forever. I remember the day I came home. Because of my injuries, this house wasn't right for me anymore. I remember the narrow doorways, the small bathrooms, the shelves out of reach when in my wheelchair. Every day was full of obstacles. I felt trapped. I remember a better day, the day my family received a specially adapted custom home from Homes for Our Troops. That day changed everything. Now we have a safe and accessible home to enjoy the freedom I fought for. This place, our home, is exactly what we needed to rebuild our lives.
Homes for Our Troops builds and donates specially adapted custom homes nationwide for severely injured post 9/11 veterans and enables them to rebuild their lives. Join our mission at hfotusa.org.
If you are just joining us, we are talking with Craig Standland, who is a best-selling author, a TEDx speaker, a coach, and a reinvention architect. And Craig, before we went to the break, we were really talking about your sense of self-worth and values. which perhaps you identify early on in your life. And then when something goes wrong, you really have to kind of take a closer look at who you are and what is important to you.
Oh, you absolutely have to. It is when life throws such a massive change at you, I don't think there's much choice but to re-examine the values. And for me, it was a matter of, originally I would have said that I had no values and that's why I made the choices that I made. But I can look at it now and say that I did have values. They were just not optimal for me. I valued money. I valued status. I valued appearances. And now, having reinvented my life, my value system is so much different and so much more fulfilling and has nothing to do with externals. It is all internal. And that ties directly to, you had mentioned the self-worth, that ties directly to that worth piece.
So I wanted to take a minute right now to introduce two guests who are joining us today in the studio, both of whom have their own journeys that they have been on in their lives and are at a point where they're reevaluating everything and maybe reflecting on what their values are as well. So welcome to you, Lou and Carol, and thank you both for being here today. So let's start off with, maybe you can, either one of you, tell us what your experience has been and in relation to this subject matter and where you see yourself headed. I think, you know, you're both making big decisions now in your life.
I'm very, very soon I'm going to be reinventing my life as well. I turned 60 at the very end of last year, and in the next month I'm moving to Israel to make Aliyah. And I haven't been in the country in nearly 30 years, so it's going to be a big reinventing myself. And but I also thought, Craig, what you said was very interesting about all the things that you went through, because a number of years ago I went through a lot of life stressors, the loss of my brother, divorce, separation, starting a job, losing a job, all within a very short period of time, and it's like the greatest things that happen to you are also the biggest learning experiences as well, and the things that we grow from the most out of great adversity.
Yeah, I mean, that's a big change in your life to pick up and move to a new country and realize that at a later point in your life that, you know, you really need to head in a new direction. And not only that, Lou, but I know you're leaving behind your mom mm-hmm. and your daughter. Mm-hmm. And so you must have done a lot of soul searching to get to this point in your life where you feel like I really need to take a drastic step.
Yeah. And I'm still doing that soul searching as well. and it's, you know, it's going to be a bittersweet thing. And it just hasn't hit me yet, all the different emotional parts of making that decision.
So, Carol.
Yes. Hello.
Okay, hi. So let's hear what you're dealing with right now. Let's put it that way. I think, you know, Lou is certainly, you know, he's made his decision, right? He is ready to head out on a new path. And I think that's where you're struggling.
Yeah, I think for me, I'm just starting the soul searching, which I think soul searching is a lifelong obligation, quite frankly. But yeah, I'm just now separated and starting the divorce process and moving home. Unlike Lou, I came home to be around my support system, my family and my friends, and trying to just figure out where I'm going. And I've got, you know, I have a teenager I need to take care of, but I also want to show him that life goes on, that just because we get the rug pulled out from under us doesn't mean that our life is over, that we can rebuild it and we can be happy and we can feel fulfilled and satisfied.
So it's interesting that you say, you know, you're just trying to find your support system. And Craig, I believe that you realized maybe while you're in prison where your support system was, and they were kind of the people. I believe it was maybe relatives and a friend who really helped you to move forward and to get to a new place in your mind and just in your life in general, right?
Yes, absolutely. And I can't express enough how important a support system is when we are reinventing. And I was so fortunate that I had a best friend of over 30 years who visited me in prison and completely changed my life. And my family was nothing short of extraordinary, so supportive through such a challenging situation. And I'm so grateful for all of them.
So, Craig, I thought it was also really powerful how you mentioned, well, you talked about when your friend came to visit you and you were so excited to, you know, talk to him and get everything off of your chest and really, like, get advice from him. But he actually came and wanted to do the same thing with you. And that at that moment, it's like you had this moment of clarity that even when... that at that moment when you're really down, you were able to provide support for someone that you thought was coming there to support you. So I think that maybe a lot of people can understand or learn to understand that they could be really down but still be in the position to help other people. And out of that strength, they can start getting out of their situation.
I think that's so important for people to understand, is that even, like you said, at our worst moments, we can still help somebody. And that's just a glimmer of light when you feel like you are surrounded by darkness, to know that even in that state, you can be of assistance to a family member or a friend. And when you're in darkness like that, all you need is just a sliver of light, and it makes all the difference.
Or even a pet. I don't want to leave the pets out. I think that they count on us too, and that they need our support too. And that even when there's no one else around, you know, we still need to take care of them. And so there's always, you know, a pet or a plant or someone that always needs
us.
Or
a child.
Yeah. Course, children. But there's always, you know, something or someone or a being around us that needs us, that we're never really truly like alone. You know, that maybe people need to just remember that if they're going through a dark time.
Yeah, I think that's important. And I also think, and Craig, you can speak to this, but I feel like it's really important to forgive yourself and to start trusting in your judgment. Again, trusting in the fact that you can make good decisions going forward after you take some time to really reconnect with what's inside of ourselves as individuals. So I think, Lou has something to say about that.
Yeah, I just think it's, as you were saying, it's important to you know, go a little easy on yourself. Don't be so hard on yourself. Be kind to yourself. Realize that this is a big thing that you're going through, and it'll take a little bit of time. I kind of use the metaphor of like when you're a little kid and you jump into a freezing cold pool, and 20 minutes later, you're still not in. You're like only up to your waist. And, you know, like when I get to Israel, I haven't been there in so long, I'm going to take it real slow. I might dive in on certain things, but for the most part, I'm just going to, you know, go one baby step at a time and you know, see how it feels and move on from there.
Do you feel like you have kind of run the course here, Lou? Maybe you feel like you can find new meaning and maybe a partner in Israel. I'm trying to get at the bottom of why you make such a large life-changing decision in terms of the path that you've chose.
I went to Israel when I was 17 years old. I was on this basketball team, and we traveled, and we had the times of our lives. And a few days into the trip, you know, I'm talking to a couple teammates, and we said, you know, gosh, this place feels like home, doesn't it? And we all agreed. And he said, I could live here. You know, I definitely would want to live here. And it was from that, you know, and my brother lived there for many years as well. And it was something that was always something I always wanted to do. And when I first got divorced, I looked into it and I realized I'm not ready for this journey, and now I am.
I just wanted to speak about the forgiveness, because I wrestle with that every day, not only forgiving myself, but forgiving other people, speaking mainly, you know, in terms of my ex. That's really important, too. It's kind of hard to forgive yourself until you can forgive other people. You have to find that in your heart, I think, before you can really move on that path to happiness. That's how I feel.
No, I agree, and I think it's just as difficult, especially if you have a child with that person. Or, you know, obviously, Craig, you were deeply connected. You know, you loved your wife, and I know, you know, and nobody wants to see their marriage end in divorce. So, you know, it's just a matter of now, maybe given the opportunity, what you would do different.
So this is an interesting question that people have posed to me before. And what I would suggest is this, is I wouldn't do anything differently because I am exactly where I am meant to be right now. And if I was to change anything, I wouldn't be where I am. And, you know, it would be easy to say to go back that I would love to be honest, I would love to do all these things, but I would not have had the experiences that have turned me into who I am. And so I have learned to love every single thing that has happened for me, as opposed to saying to me, because I believe everything has happened for me. And I just want to reiterate what Carol was saying. Forgiveness is an instrumental part of the journey. It is so important. And forgiveness for myself was one of the hardest and most important things I had to do.
So, Craig, do you have any more advice for that path to reinvention?
So I would start with what I believe is the first step of reinvention is acceptance. It is acceptance, what I call accepting reality. And I'll give an example. When I was in prison, I was writing in my journal in the prison library, and I was writing, I wish that I wasn't in prison. I wish that I was home with my wife and my dog and my cat. By the way, she had already told me that she was leaving me, so that was an impossibility. I wish I didn't make the choices I made. I wish that I wasn't a federally convicted felon. I just was wishing all of these things. And all of a sudden, I stopped and said that I'm fighting against a past that cannot be anything other than it is. And my intuition took over, and I just started writing something different. I wrote, I accept that I'm a federally convicted felon. I accept that I'm getting divorced. I went through a laundry list of things that I had to accept, and they really hurt to write them. As I was writing it, it was a very painful process because they were truths. But when I was done writing, I gave myself this amazing gift inside prison, a weight lifted off of my shoulders, and I felt freedom inside prison. And that's the power of acceptance. And I think that's really the first step of reinvention.
So essentially, you're saying perhaps our greatest adversities may be our greatest beginnings, right? You don't know what you don't know until you're confronted with those circumstances.
That's absolutely right. And it's so easy to get caught up in the fears of what may happen, but you said it perfectly. We don't know what we don't know. And when we're living in that fear state, that's all based in the future. None of us have a crystal ball. We don't know, and we just have to stay in that reality and stay connected into the present moment and realize that even though something terrible is happening, we don't know where it's going to go. And we can, by taking some certain steps, we can navigate where it's going to go.
Well, before we move on to the next things we want to talk about, let's take a quick break. You're listening to Jewish Singles Radio. We'll be right back.
When I went looking for a place to rent, I wore a mask, but they could still see that I'm black. The landlord told me,
nothing available.
When I went looking for an apartment, I wore a mask, but they could still see I'm Latino. They said,
the place has already been rented.
But I still see the unit available on the website.
When my wife and I went looking for a place to buy, we wore masks,
but they could still see that we are Asian American, and the real estate agent said,
you won't be happy here.
COVID-19 inequity is real, and it shouldn't be made worse because of housing discrimination.
If you suspect housing discrimination because of your race, color, or national origin, file a complaint with HUD or your local Fair Housing Center so we can investigate it. Go to hud.gov/fairhousing. That's hud.gov/fairhousing. Fair Housing. The law is on your side. A message from the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development in partnership with the National Fair Housing Alliance.
Hi, I'm Vivica Fox. For more than 100 years, American Humane has been helping our best friends in their worst times, during hurricanes, tornadoes, and increasingly, wildfires. They're real heroes to these animals. But Mother Nature isn't the only danger that animals face. Sometimes it's human nature that's the greatest threat. Each year, more than 6 million beautiful adoptable animals are being abandoned, and more than 1 million are euthanized before they can be rescued. These animals need heroes too. Heroes to open up their hearts and homes and to give them the love they deserve. Be a hero to an animal in need. Consider becoming an American Humane Rescue Volunteer or adopt from your local shelter. Visit AmericanHumane.org to find out how you can be a hero and help our best friends in their worst times.
We should all get together before we leave, like all the guests we've had so far.
Totally. Welcome back. So we're talking about really self-acceptance and how important that is when maybe your life's fallen apart. How do you accept what's happened? And how do you start to put the pieces back together again? So interestingly enough, during the break, because we're here in the studio together with our guests, you know, we had a sense of self-realization. Maybe, Carol, you can speak to this because you're the one who spoke up. But, you know, that you said you really don't think that you considered accepting what the circumstances are in order to move on.
That's so true. And when Craig just mentioned that, it was I actually got chills because, you know, my friends and family have all been telling me you have to accept it. And like I said, intellectually, I get it. But emotionally, acceptance is so difficult, especially when it's raw. And I would love to know how Craig worked on that acceptance. Can you just write it down and then start feeling it? I realize that's absurd, but what did you do to start feeling that acceptance? Because I think you have to really feel it and not just say it. You have to believe it.
You're touching upon something so critical in this. We can intellectually understand so many things, but until we emotionally understand them, I believe we don't truly get it. We haven't incorporated it into ourselves. And to move from that intellectual into that emotional, there has to be some kind of drive. There's got to be some kind of a why. And for me, and this is purely anecdotal in my situation, but I hope it gives a little bit of context for the conversation, is I was suffering by living in the past, by wishing that everything was different. And I was suffering trapped in the past. And because I was trapped in the past, when I thought about my future was already stained with the colors of the past. Who's going to hire a felon? Who's going to date a felon? And so it was pure torment. And I wanted to get out of that. And acceptance allowed me to get out of that. That was my why. And that led me to be able to emotionally incorporate it and move beyond the intellectual understanding of it. I hope that helped a little bit.
Absolutely. Thank you.
We were talking at the break about the five stages of grief and acceptance being one of them, and it just hit me of something that happened to me a couple years ago. I was in a life-changing work accident, and Valerie, you saw me when my hand was up in the air. In a terrible work accident, my wrist got crushed and smashed, and I had to leave my wrist up in the air for 4 months. And the doctor told me I had a 1% chance that I would heal. And half of that time, I was under the assumption I'd have to leave my wrist up in midair for the rest of my life. It was crazy. Everybody talks about how crazy 2019 was even crazier for me. And at the time, I had met a trauma therapist, and we were dating. And I'd go to the gym, and I'd say, you know, I'm lucky, and I'm grateful, and meanwhile, you know, I worked very hard to rehabilitate myself, and I did heal. But the one thing that was bothering me was when I'd go to the gym, there's a whole lot of exercises that are just completely off the menu and will be for the rest of my life in terms of push-ups and any kind of pushing with the wrist and lots of exercises there. And I tell my friend, I said, you know, I'm grateful and I realize I'm like the luckiest person on the planet, but can't help but feel sad every time I go to the gym and see other people doing push-ups and all these exercises that I'll never do again. And the person said, well, you're mourning the loss of that. And we all go through that in life, whether you're 80 years old and you're told you're no longer allowed to drive, or you lose your eyesight, or everybody goes through that in life. And, you know, you just, you need to accept that this is what it is. And you're mourning for that. That's why you're sad. And as soon as she said it, it just went away. And I no longer became sad of seeing people do other things that I wasn't going to no longer could do.
I think a big point to touch on is really just trying to identify what it is that we're feeling at the time that we are feeling it. And how do we find a way or an outlet to express that, or to even just bring out what is going on, not just in our minds, but in our lives, and deal with it. And one of the things you had mentioned that you were working with a therapist, and I know maybe it wasn't a counselor or a coach or somebody that could help you but more to heal physically. But Craig, I'm curious, did you speak with somebody who was able to help you, or a counselor along your process? And do you think that that's an important step? Because oftentimes people feel alone and secluded and nobody will understand, when in fact, you know, people deal with these kinds of life traumas, I'll say, so to speak.
I think there's a couple of things I would like to touch on there. One of them, I think it's extremely important to speak with someone. I think that is so critically important, whether it be a therapist, a coach, even a friend. You said, you know, when we feel alone, and when we feel alone, we start fostering shame. And shame lives and breathes in the dark. And how we shine a light on that is by sharing our stories and sharing how we're feeling. And that can be with anyone. And I love the fact that you mentioned pets before. And it may sound crazy, but even if you're talking to your pet just a little bit, if you're not comfortable speaking to someone else, but just speaking out loud is so important. And I didn't actually, I now work with a coach, but I went many, many years through this reinvention process, through this journey without speaking to anyone. And what I found to be one of the most beneficial tools that I started in prison, that I still do to this day, 7 years later, every single morning, I do not miss a day, is stream of conscious journaling. And that really allowed me to get what was in my mind out on paper, where it became a little bit more real. And then from there, I could work on it. I could work through it. I could see it. And just that physical representation was really important for me.
So, Craig, going back to your TED Talk, now that you brought up the journaling, you also brought up the monkey, which I thought was really, really interesting, because I think everybody experiences that. And I wanted you to maybe talk about that, how those thoughts can really, like, disable you, and how you stop those, how you stopped the monkey from intruding into your brain.
So that this is very, very interesting. So the monkey mind is really a Buddhist term that means it's unsettled and restless. And what that can really mean is when our minds, when we are sitting watching TV, we're in the car, whatever, I mean, think about how our minds work. They don't really ever shut up. And that's essentially the monkey mind. And they will bounce from topic to topic, subject to subject, waiting for the one that hooks us, waiting for that one that grabs us and then brings us down that path, which could be rumination, it could be obsession, it could be, you know, whatever it may be. But it's not a question of shutting the monkey down. It is a question of observing the monkey mind and not allowing ourselves to get caught up in whatever it is throwing out. If we do get hooked on something, to realize that we're hooked and that we're ruminating, and to bring ourselves back to neutral. And one of the tools that I think is extremely important for that is meditation. That is another practice that I started in prison. Same thing, 7 years later, I try not to miss a day. And when you meditate, you begin to observe your thoughts. And when you start observing them, you realize you're not actually your thoughts.
I think
that's a very powerful place to be.
I think it's very interesting that you say that. And maybe meditation helps you bring yourself back to yourself, really kind of explore what your identity is. Because I feel like we get lost or trapped in who we are based on our profession or based on our relationship. You're a mother or a father, you're a daughter or a son, you know. Or, you know, whatever your job might be, that's kind of how you feel, like what it is that identifies you. And then when that's taken from you in some way, where do you go? And I think meditation is a good point, but where do you go? What is the outlet so that you can start to re-identify maybe the new person that you are?
I will circle back to journaling on that. I think journaling was critically important to me to get back to who I was. When I started journaling, it was super messy. It was just so ugly. There was a lot of complaining. There was a lot of victimhood. And what I started realizing as I'm journaling every single day, there were key themes that kept popping up. That the victimhood, for example, I shouldn't be in prison. This is ridiculous. You know, I didn't really do anything that wrong. And when I started seeing those themes, like I said earlier about the journaling, it allowed me to see these things and realize, you know what, it's been 5 days in a row where I am pointing the finger. That's something for me to look at. That's something for me to take action on. And to really then, for me, using that example, it was then accepting responsibility for my actions. But I really do. I think journaling is a fantastic tool. And I also want to throw in a gratitude practice. Expressing gratitude every single day really helps ground you into who you are and really what makes you happy.
Yeah, I mean, that's a very good point, right? It's important to really be grateful for what you do have. And I think a lot of us fail to realize that often in our lives. What did you, Carol?
No, I practice gratitude every day. I don't know if I do it to the extent of what everybody else does, but I practice that every day. Meditation has been a challenge for me. I've tried it a couple of times, but I believe I'm a little bit type A. And like Craig was saying, you know, your brain doesn't shut off. But in response to that, yeah, you have to just recognize that it doesn't shut off and then move on. You can't just try to ignore it or pretend that it doesn't, because that will never work. But meditation is something that I really do want to try to get into on a regular basis.
And I would love to just throw a couple of things in there in regards to meditation. I think it's a common myth of meditation that it is to shut the mind off. And that's not at all what meditation is about. It's merely observing and the understanding and the acceptance that our brain is always going to be coming up with thoughts, and really just getting into that observation mode. And number two, what I would suggest for people who do struggle with meditation, it is difficult, it is hard, but 5 minutes is better than 0 minutes. And going for a walk can actually be a meditation. Lou goes to the gym. The gym can be a meditation. If you're very focused on what it is that you're doing, if you're focused on your walk, if you're focused on each repetition that you make in the gym, that's a form of meditation. So we can look at it in several different ways and use that as an access point to get to sitting in silence for longer periods of time.
I also wanted just to add to that I know with my own experience, anytime I would find myself not thinking about what bothers me, I would consider meditation. So even if I would be washing the dishes and looking at those dishes and washing them, I would be like, oh, wow, that was 5 minutes. I didn't think about, you know, something bad that I don't want to be thinking about. And I think that that could be a way someone can start meditating with those little steps of just realizing when you're not thinking about something bad and how you can not think about those things and you can put your mind on something else.
I think that's very important to add into that. Sorry to interrupt. I think that's very important. Anything can be a meditation if you are washing the dishes is such a beautiful example of just the warm water, the soap, the dish in your hand, and just focusing on that and nothing else. You're just doing the dishes. You're present in that moment with the dish.
Well, then I can say that I meditate an awful lot, several times a day.
There's a lot of dishes in your house.
A lot of dishes. I seem to be the dishwasher.
I did want to talk about something else that you spoke about, Craig, which I felt very traumatizing and really deep is, you know, that, and I think a lot of people might get to this point when they're struggling with something like this, is that you felt suicidal. You actually felt like you wanted to die. And I think sometimes we get to a point where we think, you know, there's no way back. We're, you know, at our lowest point. And you actually even talk about, you know, envisioning having a gun and, you know, shooting yourself and all of that. And I know it sounds extreme, but it's important, I think, to talk about what happens when you're at the lowest of the low and how you bring yourself out of that, you know, aside from meditation or even journaling. And, you know, we've talked about meditation and journaling and we talked about speaking with somebody. But when you're in a prison or alone and you're in a space where maybe you're not comfortable speaking to somebody or, you know, you don't even feel like you can write down what you're going through, how do you kind of just negotiate those low points and try and see the light at the end of the tunnel? Like, this is not the situation that you're going to have forever, you know, to realize that, you know, I am going to be able to move past this. But I am going to be different.
I want to thank you for bringing this up because I think it is such an important topic that has a stigma to it. And oftentimes people will shy away from it, which only adds to the stigma. And whoever is in that dark place is less inclined to seek help. So thank you for bringing this up. And I think one of the key things to remember, if you find yourself in that rock bottom, in that dark place, is to ask yourself a question. Do I really want to die or do I not want to feel this way anymore? And looking at my situation, I just didn't want to feel that way anymore. I didn't want to be consumed by shame. I didn't want to feel miserable every single day and with the realization that I blew up my life. I didn't want to feel that way anymore. I didn't really want to die. And something that I read from, I believe it was the author and blogger, Tim Ferriss, he wrote that pain that you're feeling when you're at your worst, take that pain, multiply it by 1,000 and put it in your loved ones' hearts because that's what they're going to feel if you move forward with what you're thinking of moving forward with. And I found that to be extremely, extremely powerful. And there's a third one that you touched upon already, is the understanding that everything is temporary, which is tough because when you're in it, it feels like it's going to be that way forever. But everything is temporary, and remembering that is very powerful.
I think that those words were really powerful, too. I think that a lot of people who may know someone in that situation will, you know, maybe be able to give them the advice that you just gave or be able to reach out to them. And I know we're going to wrap up soon, but before we do, I wanted you to maybe give your information where someone can reach you or someone can, I know that you do life coaching. And how can they get a hold of you?
Or even to get a hold of your book and to read your experience.
thank you again for this opportunity. And Lou and Carol, it was such a pleasure speaking with you. I really appreciate our conversation. My book is titled Blank Canvas, How I Reinvented My Life After Prison, and it's available on Amazon. And my website is craigstanland.com. And I think those are the two really good starting points to get to know me. And then you referenced the TED Talk. If you Google Craig Stanland TED Talk, it will bring you to either the TED main website or the YouTube.
You know, Craig, I wanted to just say something to you personally that I hear every time you mention, like, prison. It's a little bit of not like the most pleasant thing that you want to talk about, but I think it gives you some street cred where you can talk about a lot of different aspects of hitting rock bottom, where it's not always associated to one thing. And I want to thank you for being honest and open about that and not trying to not talk about that. So I just wanted to say that to you just for myself.
I really appreciate that. And part of my reinvention process was unraveling the shame that I felt. And I understood that if my story owned me, it was going to own my life. If I own my story, I own my life. And part of my story is prison, as unpleasant as it was. It's a part of my story. It's a part of me and makes me who I am today. And I have to acknowledge and accept that.
You know, one of the things, Craig, that you also said is that, you lost your relationship and your marriage. And I think, you know, that's one of the key things that we talk about here is about forming relationships, about relationships that break up for whatever reason, and how we get back to finding someone or something else that makes us happy. And I know you said you had maybe 3 or 3.5 years that you were in fact alone, and now you actually have a person in your life, and maybe this is a little personal, but a person that you are dating. So in that sense, I kind of feel like a lot of people feel I'm never going to meet somebody again. Nobody is ever going to, you know, make me feel that way again. But even after all you have been through, you did meet somebody who understands you and what the experience is that you had to go through in your life, your journey.
I'm so fortunate to have met my girlfriend and her acceptance of my past. It's such a beautiful thing. And the way that she handled the news when I told her was very powerful and very empathetic and very understanding. So I'm unbelievably grateful for that. And I think you said something really important there, and we touched upon that even with the suicide. It's tied to everything is temporary. We feel like we're never going to feel that way again. But that's not true. You know, it will subside, and we will find somebody new. And I really think a huge part of that is doing that inner work and the forgiveness and building the self-trust and practicing that acceptance. And when we do that, we start opening up our lives to other people so that others can come in.
Carol, I know you're deep in thought, but I kind of feel like this, you're feeling, you know, like kind of evaluating the application of this to your circumstance.
Well, very much so. And I think that I'm really kind of gleaning onto the acceptance. I think that's my next step. But I did also want to say in regards to suicide, because I think that a lot of people will have fleeting thoughts of suicide when things are not going their way. And I'm sure that Craig probably has heard this before, but I've heard that, you know, suicide is a permanent solution to a temporary problem, which relates directly to what you were talking about, Craig, about do you really want to not exist, or do you just want to not feel this way? And that's so important to really distinguish the difference. So
it is so important to delineate, and thank you for bringing that up. And I love that I've heard that before, and it's so powerful. Permanent solution to a temporary problem.
Right.
I think that's important for everybody to connect with. And I agree with you that I think at some point, if everybody were very honest with themselves, they've had that fleeting thought of ending things.
Sure.
Yeah.
I just think of all the people I would be letting down if I, you know, everybody, I think everybody kind of thinks of that at one time or another, or You know, just as a glancing thought, you know, if you're on a balcony or something, you know, you just, you know, what if I, you know, and then you just like, you know, that's a crazy thought. I, you know.
Or you face the fear, right? You face the fear of maybe doing something or getting yourself
just
into
just for a
predicament.
Second, just for a second, you know, right. And then you think, I mean, because I see, you know, when I see, you know, pictures of Robin Williams and Anthony Bourdain and all these other you know, and it's unfortunate, but, you know, they went through this hard thing and they felt that there was no way out.
It's true. I mean, really, you have to hang in there. This is, you know, it's a journey.
It's
and
not easy.
Every day of it is a different experience. New doors open, new doors close. And it's one of the reasons, Craig, that I was really so drawn to your story. And I think a lot of people can relate in just having to start your life over. And when you're 50... You know, and you kind
or
of
so.
Think, right, or so, you feel, kind of feel like, you know, you had it all worked out. You were where you were supposed to be, at least in your mind. So, you know, taking a look at somebody else, somebody else's journey had helped me to, you know, better understand, like, there's other people in pain and other people that are suffering because of the experiences that they've had to deal with in their life. So I really appreciate you joining us today, Craig, and you, Carol, and Lou. Again, Craig, your book is A Blank Canvas, How I Reinvented My Life After Prison, for people who might be interested in reading that. And Diana, since we're wrapping up, I just wanted to see if you had any final thoughts.
No, I just, you know, I really got a lot of inspiration listening to your TED Talk, and I wanted to encourage everybody to download it and listen to it and to get in touch with you if they need any advice. It seems like you have a lot of wisdom to share with people that are struggling. And I want to thank our guests for coming in.
Thank you.
My pleasure.
This is Jewish Singles Radio. You can hear us every Wednesday night at 7 o'clock on WWDB and wherever you hear your local podcasts. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Bye, everybody.